You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 102. The first draft of anything is crap, but it's infinitely better than no draft. Ben Arment.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Now, guys, it's hard to deny the impact that Blake Schneider's Save the Cat book series on Hollywood screenwriting. Rarely does a book change the way screenwriters approach story and structure. Well, today's guest is one of Blake Schneider's students. His name is Salva Rubio, and he wrote the book Save the Cat Goes to the Indies, The Screenwriter's Guide to 50 Films from the Masters. And in this episode, me and Salva go deep into independent film, independent voices, and we also break down multiple genres from horror to mystery to the superhero story in the independent film, which is not what you think it is, and so much more. So this is a really great conversation. I can't wait to share it with you guys. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Salva Rubio. I'd like to welcome to the show Salva Rubio. How are you doing, Salva?
Hi. Hi, Alex, and hi to all your viewers and listeners. We're doing fine here in Barcelona.
Very cool. And that's why I always love technology. I mean, we're literally across the world from each other, and we're still able to do this. It's still, I don't take it for granted. I'm old enough to know when this was not a thing.
Yeah, you know, there's an apocalypse going on outside, so let's just hope that there is not a solar storm or something like that that would wipe everything. But 2020 has been crazy so far, so why not? Alien invasion and
zombies, alien. I'd say zombies, alien invasion, mole people. Mole people haven't risen up from the bottom yet, from the core of the planet to take over. Atlantis hasn't risen. I mean, there's a few things that are yet to be done, but we still have 2 months.
Well, we have a couple of months, and 2020 so far has been exciting, but maybe it needs to go with a bang, with the real bang.
You know, no excitement. No, please. We've had enough excitement this year to last us a decade, if not two. But we're here to talk about Save the Cat in your book, Save the Cat Goes Indie. And I wanted to bring you on the show because we've had people on the show before to talk about Blake's world with Save the Cat, his groundbreaking work. But I wanted to bring you on because of the indie aspect of it, because a lot of my listeners are indie filmmakers. So before we get going on that, how did you get involved with Save the Cat?
Sure. Well, I mean, it all starts like in 2004 or so. I finished my university degree, which here is licenciatura, and then I decided that I wanted to work in film somehow, and I found a job in a production company which also has it was a half production, also distribution, also exhibition. It was like the most important indie production company, distribution company, and so on in Spain. So I started reading scripts, just like so many people. Well, the lucky thing about my job is that I could read a lot of big names scripts. I mean, it wasn't just like spec scripts, you know, like people trying to get into the industry. We had a share of that. But all of a sudden I had a David Cronenberg screenplay, or maybe a Michael Haneke screenplay, or maybe, you know, a Danny Boyle screenplay, because they were, in Europe it's very common to show your screenplay around before the film is done so that you can start getting money, you know, because you, as a foreign production company, you can get European money, but it has to be done in advance. And it was a funny thing because I was reading these screenplays and wondering how the resulting film would be. But then a couple of years later, I would see that film on the cinemas, in the theaters, and I would be, you know, like, wow, from that screenplay to that movie, there's such a big distance. But in visual terms, the screenplay was there. And that got me thinking, you know, like, wow, so the screenplay can be a classic thing, and then the film can be an avant-garde thing. And I think it was in 2007, because I have a very bad memory. But Blake Snyder came to Spain, actually. He had a gig in London, I think, and he went through Barcelona. And I was lucky enough to be there with him, to meet him, and to take his seminar. And that changed my whole view, because I realized that there was, I was an aspiring writer, and I realized there was a method, there was a guideline, there was something that could help me in my learning.
Very cool. And then can you go over a little bit about what Save the Cat is for people who are not familiar with Save the Cat?
Yeah, sure. Save the Cat is one of the most, one of the best-selling screenwriting books in history. I couldn't say if it's the best-selling one or not, but it's one of the most important. And it came and took the world by surprise in the mid-2000s. Because they were very good, nice, established books. They were all a bit serious, a bit academic. And Blake, he was a comedy writer. He did quite a funny book about screenplay and screenwriting structure, full of interesting, funny, even childish terms. But the result was that it was a very easy-to-follow method based on 12 steps, the Blake Snyder beat sheet. And, well, it became a bestseller because for students and also for executives, it became like a pattern of how a film should feel.
And can you go over those 12 beats, the Blake's beats, and kind of talk about them a little bit?
Yeah, well, I can try by memory. But first of all, you have the opening image. The opening image is the view of the world before the adventure happens. You know, there's a world with a systemic problem. We still don't know how to fix it, but it's there somewhere. Then we have the setup, which is the moment in which we come to meet our main character. It's usually two or three scenes watching him or her in his everyday life, just to get to know him or her. At this point, there's another beat called the theme stated, in which another character, secondary character, maybe a mentor, tells the main character, the protagonist, the theme. So you should learn this. Then we have the catalyst, which is like the inciting incident. You know, halfway through the first act, something happens that pushes the story forward. And then we have something called the debate, which is a few scenes still in the first act, in which the main character tries to avoid that adventure and thinks of ways to avoid that. But obviously, that's not going to happen. He has to go on this story. So we have what Blake called the break into Act 2, which is that first twist. And we enter Act 2, where we have a very long act, as everyone who's trying to write the screenplay knows. But Blake called the first part of this second act, he called it the fun and games. And that is a very important concept, because the fun and games section is where the writer has fun and games, not merely the protagonist. If you're right. telling a horror story, the protagonist is not going to have any fun. But this is where the poster moments are, where the trailer moments are. This is where you show what the people came to see, is what Blake called the promise of the premise. Then we have the midpoint, which is a very important bit, like a kind of a temple, holds the picture together. And we have this victory, in which the character feels, oh, so this adventure is easier than I thought. I don't have to change at all. But then we have the fall defeat, in which the baddies, the evil characters, take notice of the hero and start attacking him or her. So we enter the second part of Act 2, and we are in what Blake called the bad guy's close-in, as the name is self-explaining, as the name says, is where the main character has to become a warrior. He has to become someone to defend, depending on which genre. We can be in a horror film and he has to fight the monster, or he can be in a film about grieving and he has to confront his feelings. Then come three so important bits to finish the second part of the second act. Blake used to call them, they are called All is Lost, which is like this belly of the whale moment that writers know very well. But then he had something called the Dark Night of the Soul, which is a time for sadness, a time for regret, because the main character couldn't change or didn't know how to change. And then we have what Blake called a break into Act 3, which is a moment of illumination, a moment of precision. The main character wants to change, but still doesn't know how to change. So we have the Act 3. And in the Act 3, here's something cool. In his third book, Blake devised five bits more, which I can say, so there are not actually 12, but we can say there are actually 17. So in Act 3, we have the preparation, where people, main characters and heroes prepare for the duel. Then the duel starts. Then at the middle of the duel, there's going to be a reversal, something that I like to call the it's a trap moment. And then we have duel per se, antagonist and protagonist, they fight each other, and the protagonist has some sort of final illumination, like Luke Skywalker hearing Obi-Wan say, use the Force. And then, usually the bad guy is defeated, and then we have the final image, in which we use as a mirror. We have the opening image and the closing image, and those should be different. We should see that something has changed in that universe. Whoa.
That was amazing, Salva. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. That was that off the top of your head. I don't know what you're talking about. You don't have good memory.
Well, I'm a teacher also, so I guess it's kind of in my head that I wasn't sure if I could pull it off, but boy, it happened.
It's hardwired in. Now you've seen a lot of, I'm assuming from writing your book, you did a tremendous amount of research watching a ton of independent films. What is the biggest mistake you see in independent film?
That's an interesting question. I mean, independent film, as you know, is a universe, a different universe per se. And okay, my biggest insight is this. People usually say that there are two kinds of screenplays. First, the literary screenplay, so to speak, and then the technical screenplay. One is more like, for the screenwriter, and the other one is for the director. And I don't believe that. I think you need a sales screenplay and a shooting script.
Right.
And those are different because many people try to write the film of their dreams, but it's sometimes so different, so weird, so intense or so unapproachable.
Unmarketable.
Unmarketable, yeah, that's the word. So investors and other kind of people who must like it, they become scared. So I would say give us a good screenplay, clear, that I can visualize, that feels classic, that doesn't feel like too innovative, that doesn't feel like too strange or weird. And then at some point, during the development process, speaking with people with the money in your pocket, then you can realize your vision.
Okay. Now, can we go over, I want to go over a couple of the genres that you kind of spoke about in your book, which I thought, I would love the names of these. So, that, and how Save a Cat approaches these specific, genres. So Monster in the House.
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying that the genres are really useful. I mean, these are an invention. Blake sort of invented them. It's what we could call universal storylines, and every story fits one of them. So they are like a kind of short talk to understand each other. I mean, normal genres are like Westerns, which are movies with cowboys usually, or horror movies, movies with a monster or so. But sometimes you have a Western, there's a guy with a hat, but it can be a horror story. Mm-hmm. It can be a comedy. It can be, you know, it's a problem because traditional genres don't tell you the story. They just speak about the aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem when you need someone to picture in their mind your screenplay. So the Blake Snyder genres, they tell the story. So Monster in the House, for example, is usually horror. Not always horror, but it's usually horror. And what is cool about the genres is that Blake realize that for these genres to work, you need a few elements. And if those elements are not there, well, it's going to feel incomplete, you know? So, for example, Monster in the House, as the name says, you have a monster, you need a supernatural creature, you need a house, you need people locked inside a place. You need maybe a mansion, maybe a hospital, or maybe a country like... in 28 days later.
Yeah, 28 days later. Yeah. London.
Yeah, 28 days later. Yeah. So then you need a couple of things more. Like, for example, you need a scene. People need to deserve what is happening to them. And then you see you have enough elements for a pitch. You can refer to horror as a well-known genre that can help people understand your film. But still you can... you can throw in the elements that are going to make that story original. Like, I don't know, you're writing a slasher film. Well, we know they are all the same, but you can say, so this is a slasher with this new monster I've invented, or in this new setting that no one has ever done. And I think it's a way to focus really soon in those original points your script needs to have.
Yeah, so kind of like Alien was obviously a monster in the house, but it was the first time that anyone had done it in a spaceship before.
That's it.
Yeah. Now, the Golden Fleece. What is that genre?
Well, the Golden Fleece are basically road movies. They're basically road movies. Golden Fleece is an element in Greek mythology. The whole Golden Fleece was... something like a lamb. I'm not sure if
it was a lamb. It was a lamb-like thing. Yeah, skin, lamb skin,
lamb skin. It was magical and it could turn anyone into a powerful person, but it was guarded by a dragon in a very distant part of the Mediterranean, and you had to physically go there. So these are the most basic stories, like in Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey. Which a hero has to go somewhere and get something to be happier, to be healthier for his community. But this can be, for example, this great film by David Lynch, this Straight Story. Mm-hmm. You know, it was about an old man going in a tractor across America. But that's it. It's a road movie after all. So, we also need a few elements. We need a road, like, for example, in The Wizard of Oz, the road is, well, the yellow brick road. But in this film I just mentioned, that is, or in Little Miss Sunshine, is the way from Albuquerque to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You need a team. The team is the people that are going with you or that you are going to find in the way. For example, in Little Miss Sunshine is the family, but it's important to see that the family of Little Miss Sunshine and the companions of Dorothy in Wizard of Oz, they're kind of similar. One of them is the heart, other one is the brain, other is the will, and so on. And the funny thing about this genre is that you need what Blake called a road apple at the end. You need some sort of disillusionment or a deception at the end. Every character that arrives to the end of that physical journey will find bad news. Will find that which they were looking for, like, for example, the Wizard of Oz, I want to go home. Well, you realize that the Wizard of Oz is a fraud, a fake. And, well, you cannot go home using his power. You need to go home by your own means. And that's what this story is about.
Now, Dude with a Problem is another cool one.
Yeah. Well, Dude with a Problem is basically thrillers and action films. Dude with a Problem, as you can see, all of these have like a mythological origin. In fact, in the Save the Cat blog, we have been publishing a few articles about how these genres have their origin in mythological tales. And in Dude with a Problem, it could be the Hercules story. He was a normal guy. He didn't think he was special, but all of a sudden, he was tested by the gods. So Dude with a Problem are those stories, like, for example, Die Hard, Jim McLean, and Hercules. They're the same guy. They are ordinary guys versus extraordinary odds. And, well, they need to find their own strength and their own power. They need to believe in themselves to defeat the gods themselves. So, well, that's a really intense genre.
So, it's a genre like that. A lot of the examples you just gave are very big movies, big movies. Okay. So, in the indie world, are there examples? Because Dude with a Problem, like Die Hard for indies, is a little rough. Though it can be done, I guess, if you're like in a school somewhere and the school is taken over by terrorists, and you're the kid. So I'm just writing a story right now, and you're the kid is John McClane. It's basically Home Alone, but on an indie budget. Are there any examples of like specifically like Dude with a Problem or the Golden Fleece or Monster in the House? Obviously most horror films are monster, low budget, but like low budget, more indie stuff.
Yeah, sure. In the book, in Save the Cat Goes to the Indies, there's 50 films that we we analyze, and there's 10 genres, 5 films for each genre, and all of them are independent. Like, for example, let me just tell you the 5 we have in Monster in the House. We have 28 Days Later. We have The Lives of Others, which won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Mm-hmm. We have The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
We have the, and The Blair Witch Project.
Of course.
Which was so cheap, you know, a couple of cameras. And then we have Funny Games, which again is only one location. In Golden Fleece, we have Little Miss Sunshine. We have Oh Brother, Reservoir Dogs, The Strayer Story, which I just mentioned, and The Full Monty. People may say Full Monty, that's not a road film. But in this category, you also have the Road to Perfection films, in which people get better doing something, you know?
So another genre that that I saw in the book was the superhero genre. Now, a lot of people think when they think superhero, they think Marvel, they think DC, they think Superman or Spider-Man or X-Men or one of these big budget things. How can you apply the superhero genre in the indie world?
Well, the funny thing is that superheroes existed before the caped superheroes, you know. A superhero in mythical terms, it was a different person with special abilities. It could be physical abilities, like, for example, Achilles. He was invulnerable, you know. No one could, bullets or arrows couldn't hurt him. That's a superhero in my book, you know. Mm-hmm. And he had his own kryptonite, which was the Achilles heel. So these kind of characters have been around always. And in our there can be normal people, so to speak, their powers may not be evident. Their powers may not be like flying or having X-rays in their eyes, but charisma can be a superpower, like any politician can tell you, or the ability to inspire others. And in our list, we have, for example, Erin Brockovich. Mm-hmm. As you remember, it was an indie, and it was a film by Steven Soderbergh. And it was a woman that, well, she defeated a big company out of her willpower and out of her love for other people. That is also a superhero. The others we have is Fantastic Mr. Fox. You know, mm-hmm. how you remember how he became the leader of his pack, literally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We also have Raziel by Terry Gilliam, and also The Elephant Man. Because the superhero genre, my favorite thing about it is that people with, you know, underdogs and people which are ignored by society, they are really powerful because they know how to survive in very harsh environments. Like the normal world for you and me is not really dangerous, but for many people with disabilities, for example, the normal world is a challenge. That's why they are so brave and so admirable. That's why we have the Elephant Man, and we have a proper comic book superhero in this list, which also was an indie. I'm sure you'll remember it. We may be close in age. It was The Crow.
Sure. Yeah, and The Crow was an indie production.
I think so.
Yeah, and I'm going to be having the director of that film on the show very, very soon, Alex Proyas. Yeah, I'm super excited to have him on the Indie Film Hustle podcast, because I love The Crow, and I thought The Crow it's a masterpiece. I mean, obviously it was tragic what happened with Brandon Lee and all of that, but the movie itself it's almost an anti superhero film.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The comic book was great. I mean, if you can read it, it's great. But also, the people that are hearing you, they won't realize, but the people that are watching this, they will realize I'm a metalhead. So The Crow, man, that was a metalhead film of the 90s.
Sure. Oh, yeah, that soundtrack. Stone Temple Pilots, Nine Inch Nails. Oh, it's good.
Pantera.
Yeah. Pantera, good stuff. Good stuff. I think Smashing Pumpkins was on there as well. I think there was a song by Smashing Pumpkins. Yeah. It was amazing. It was a great, great soundtrack. It was just at the same time I was in college. So I was watching that movie and listening to that soundtrack constantly in the 90s. But yeah, and then like thinking about superhero as well, like someone like Sherlock Holmes, he has a superhero power, which is his intellect. So a lot of times the superhero genre, even in the indie world, can be someone who's just smarter than everybody else, or has this, like, he's excellent at a specific thing that nobody else is. They are high achievers, or are their abilities in one area is so far beyond everybody else that that's considered a superhero, correct?
Correct. Also because most superheroes at some point are rejected by society. I mean, the lesson in the classic superhero, and I'm talking about myth especially, the lesson is that many of them will be rejected because they are too powerful, or because people are envious of their power, or because they inspire people, so they are dangerous. I mean, like, for example, a film like Malcolm X or Gandhi, or films about Che Guevara, those are films about political leaders, but they can be told as a superhero story because they have that power, which is inspiring people and leading them to freedom. And that is dangerous for the bad guys.
Or the establishment, if it goes against the establishment. That's a great. I never thought about Gandhi and Malcolm X as superheroes, but I guess that is a broad definition of what a superhero is, which is anybody who has an ability that nobody else has, and makes them special. Hence, superhero. Yeah. Superhero. Yeah. Another genre I loved, and I'd love to hear your take on it, is When the Fool Triumphs. Which is a great indie. It could be a great indie genre.
Yeah, it's great indie material. I mean, The Fool Triumphant is another story that has its roots in the mythical past, but it's good material, especially for comedy, because The Fool Triumphant is basically the story of the village fool. I think that's also the name in English. And it's about that character, that underdog, which everyone just ignores because, okay, he is silly or he doesn't see the world as the rest of the people, or, well, I mean, he just looks or feels like a fool. But I love this genre because, you know, most genres start with most stories start with a character which needs to change. They need a transformation. So some of them start being like a bit, let's say, wrong or bad, a bit stupid, a bit evil, whatever. They have a flaw and they need to overcome that flaw. But fools in films, fools are mostly well-meant and they are mostly good people. So they cannot just have a normal arc like other characters. That could imply for them to become worse. So in this genre, the kind of change we're aiming for is adaptation. They need to adapt to that world without losing their inner light, you know, without losing that which makes them nice and special.
So like Forrest Gump is a good example of that. Like Forrest Gump doesn't change, but he adapts from when he's a boy all the way to the end, being a multimillionaire. Ex-Vietnam vet, Medal of Honor winner, and all the other amazing things that happens to that character. But he does adapt to the world, but he never changes. He doesn't get harsher. He doesn't change his inner light. Can you give us a couple of examples of indies in that genre?
Sure. I need to say also that the book is called Save the Cat Goes to the Indies, and it also includes European films, which are technically indies, and auteur films in general. So that's why in this category we have, for example, The King's Speech,
which was a European movie.
Yeah.
It was
British, right? I think.
Yeah, but it was independent is a loose term with that because it won the Oscar and it looked fantastic.
you mean that it won? Yeah, it won an Oscar, but I think production wise, I mean, we were very careful. I don't remember the details, but I think we were very careful to select films that would fit independent.
Okay.
Otherwise,
well, considering it's not a studio project to say the least, and it's definitely an indie story to say the least, because that's not something a studio would pick up. They might pick it up for distribution after it's made, and I think that's what happened with King's Speech. Do you have some other examples?
Yeah, sure. For example, Life is Beautiful, which also won an Academy Award.
Sure.
It's an Italian film.
Mm-hmm.
And also there was a film that made huge waves in the past, but it's been like sort of forgotten, but it's a great film. It's called The Artist.
Oh, yeah. The one that won the Oscar.
Yeah, they all won the Oscar. The Artist was that black and white film about sound film and silent film and how a character had to adapt. And we have a couple more. We have Boogie Nights, which is this the fool in the porn industry in the 70s,
right,
by Paul Thomas Anderson. It was a terrific film. And we have a special category for our last film, which is The Dark Fool. It's people which are playing fool, but they want to take advantage of others, and that is Match Point.
Oh,
by Woody Allen.
Yeah, and that's the Dark Fool is interesting a concept as well. There's so many different, and in the book you go through all these different movie examples, which are great. So you really can kind of connect the genre with actual films that you can kind of start applying to in your scripts. Which brings me to my next question. When a screenwriter is working on a screenplay, specifically aiming it at an independent film market, should they be thinking about budget? Should they be thinking about how it's going to get produced, or should they just kind of go wild?
I think if it's your first film, you should have the budget into consideration, obviously, because they will trust you if you can make a cheap film and it works and it looks great. It says that you are a good general in this fight, in this battle. It says that with very few elements, you can make a worthy thing. You know, I think one of the a very good film in this regard, just let me check because sometimes I forget the names, but I'm sure your listeners remember Pi.
Yeah.
The first film of Darren Aronofsky, which was grainy and dark, and it was so cheap, but that made it so special. There's no film alike. So I think if you aim for what can I do with a little money, how can I make this look special? Not maybe great, because some people put all their money in trying to make the film look professional, but that same make it look special, make it look different as a director, and show your identity and show us what you can do with what you have.
But also, I think that takes a level of not only bravery, but also of someone who's extremely comfortable in their own skin. Because I know as when I was coming up, you try to emulate other directors, you try to emulate other storytellers or other screenwriters because you're afraid of your own voice. You maybe haven't found it yet. You haven't developed it yet. And you're afraid to put yourself out there completely wholly. But these examples of you that you've talked about, many of those screenwriters and directors, like Pi is a fantastic example. He was a young director and just came out and did exactly what he wanted in a very, like, there's still no film look that looks like Pi. Pi was this grainy black and white 16 millimeter high kinetic energy, wonderful story, mysticism in it. It was an amazing introductory film. But it's, you could just see the bravery in it. I mean, Reservoir Dogs, obviously, is a great example of that as well. I mean, look at Tarantino and his writing and how he shot it and what he did. It's remarkable. But I think you do need to have a sense of comfortability as an artist. And I think that goes for any artist, right? In any genre, in any craft, whether it's musician, whether it's art, painting, writing.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's a temptation to say, well, maybe if I don't do what I like and I do what they like, maybe I can have a shot at it. But, you know, I think life is very short and sometimes you don't get many chances. So I would be happier with shooting the film I like and I can be proud of and I can show my family and I can say to my friends, this is a story I've been meaning to tell for all this time. And if that is the last thing, the last film I shoot, okay, so be it. But I'm proud, you know? But if I just go with what they want, I am going to be restless. And I'm going to be, you know, sort of unhappy maybe. So some people don't have the choice and some people do good, you know? They shoot something they are hired to shoot and then they go on to make their own stuff. And that is great also. But if I had to choose, I would always choose, I'll do what I want and then I'll see what they want.
Exactly. It's a difficult path regardless, as a screenwriter, as a director, especially in the indie space. Do you have any advice on getting your screenplay, your independent film screenplay produced? Anything that you can kind of put in there or presentation or whatever, anything that you could do as a writer to help you have a better shot of actually getting produced?
Well, I mean, the world right now, as we were saying, the world is crazy, but it's crazy in a good sense. I grew up professionally reading all these screenwriting books from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and they all said the same thing. Write your script in this way, and then you print it, and then there's a three-punch thing, and then you send it with an introduction, and that is out. I mean, that is
God.
Not valid anymore. So we are writing history. We are finding new ways to do it. So I always say, if you have a mobile phone in your pocket, shoot the film. Shoot the damn film tomorrow. Get your friends and do it, and then show it in YouTube or whatever. Because for me right now, the difference is not make it that big film that will put you on the map. It's making a ton of films, short films, episodes, ads, whatever. Get into the industry, have friends, that will help you with your films, and you will help them with their films, and then this guy knows one guy, and then he puts you in touch, and things happen outside your room, and things happen outside home, and you need to meet as many people as you can and help them as much as you can. And I think that the gears start moving, and then at some point you have a chance. But if you try to do everything by yourself, well, that's going to be difficult.
Very much, very, very much. Trust me, I've done it myself, so it's not easy. It's not easy to do. Now, what's up? What's up? What's next for you? What are you working on?
Yeah, well, right now, I just finished a new draft of an animation film I'm doing for. It's a co-production. It's a production company in New York and in Spain. So they are trying to build, you know, this project. It's an animation young adult thing, let's we could say that. And also I'm doing a lot of graphic novel stuff, which in the US is mostly superheroes and indie comic books and graphic novels. But here we have many more genres. And if I may say so, I just had a graphic novel released in the US by the US Naval Institute. And it's a concentration camp story. It's a real story about the Spaniards that were in Nazi concentration camps, which is something that not many people know. And it's about the crazy plan some of them have to steal pictures of what was happening in the camp and take them out for the world to know. They did it. It's not really a well-known story, but it's fascinating. So I invite you to read The Photographer of Mauthausen. It's called by the U.S. Naval Institute. And that's the last thing I released in America.
Very cool. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What are three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Oh, my God. You know, first name pops in my head always is John Cameron.
James Cameron. Yeah,
James Cameron. He writes so well. So I would say anything by James Cameron, like, for example, Aliens, that would be great. Little Miss Sunshine, it's
He didn't do that one. Oh, James Cameron didn't do Aliens, but Little Miss Sunshine's another one.
Yeah, that's another one.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't remember James Cameron, because I would actually watch James Cameron's Little Miss Sunshine. That would be amazing.
It would be a different film. It would probably be called... Little Big Dark Knight or something like that, you know. Like,
and there'll be some sort of 3D animal or creature running around.
Yeah, I will watch that one. Yeah, and probably, you know, I've been the first Indiana Jones or some films like those, because they are straight to the point, funny scenes, quick to read, and okay, yes, they are Hollywood scripts, but why not? Anyway, you know, each year we're lucky because the Academy publishes all the screenplays and there's a few indies in there. So that's also to take into consideration. And just let me say one more. It's Amour, Love by Michael Haneke, because it will break any expectation. It's a 67-page script that results in a film of 127 minutes. So, you know, people that say, no, it's one page, 1 minute. Well, not always.
So that's not a script to look at proper formatting. You might want to, but it does the job,
Yeah. Yeah.
So what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
I'd say write a ton of stuff. I'd say don't write 1, 2, 3 screenplays and think you're done and your talent is there. And no, write one every 2 months or every 3 months or every 4 months. But write one, finish another, keep making friends. And somehow, if you have 10 screenplays, it's easier to make it than if you have 2.
And where can people find out more about Save the Cat and your book?
Well, there's a blog, savethecat.com. And weekly, there's articles and new beat sheets. So if you're interested, there's a ton of research material there. And my own website is salvarubio.info, just like my name. Well, there's the stuff I've been publishing lately.
Very cool. Salva, man, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been, it was a wonderful talking indie Save the Cat. I'm a fan of Save the Cat. I talk to everybody and I talk to all the different kinds of story systems and I just find that they all are going to the same place. We're all trying to tell good stories at the end of the day. So I do appreciate you coming on, man, and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you so much, Alex, and thanks for everyone for listening. And, you know, don't give up. Keep writing. Keep shooting. You'll make it.
I want to thank Salva for coming on the show and sharing his knowledge with the tribe today. Thank you so much, Salva. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including links on how to get the book, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/102. And guys, next week I have a big surprise coming to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Tribe, so stay tuned. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.
What are you guys doing? You're still here? You're still listening? Well, then you guys are true Bulletproof Screenwriting Tribe members. And because you're still listening to this episode, even after I obviously ended it, you guys truly, truly are passionate about what you're doing. So I want to give you guys a special sneak peek to my new masterclass, which I have teamed up with no other than James V. Hart, the writer of Hook, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and Contact, just to name a few of his many screenplays. He is a working master of the craft. And we teamed up to bring you guys the Hart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass. This concept of the Hart Chart was first developed with Francis Ford Coppola while they were making Dracula back in the early 90s. And he has been using this system ever since and has been sharing this system with Oscar-winning and blockbuster screenwriters throughout the industry for years before he finally just sat down and started to put it all together, which culminated in this masterclass. Now, drawing on 3 decades as a major film industry screenwriter and 20 years of leading seminars and workshops around the world, the Hart Chart Masterclass provides an immersion into the Hart Chart visual story mapping tool directly taught by James V. Hart. And in this masterclass, you will learn how to get your script production and market ready. Now, if you want early access before next week to get this course, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/HART chart. And not only do you get the masterclass, but you get hours and hours of exclusive interviews with Oscar winners Jordan Peele and Damon Chazelle, along with a ton of other extras, including the book, The Writer's Toolkit, which James wrote as well. I'm super excited to bring this to the tribe, but because you guys are true believers, you get first access. So again, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. Thanks so much for listening, guys, and I'll talk to you next week.